Okay, well, thank you very much, Tony, and thanks for everybody for joining in today in this web approach, which is sort of new to me. I've only done this once before. I guess it's the new technologies for us people have been around for a while, but it sounds like a good way to do it, save energy, not flying in airplanes and all that. But having said that, I got involved in the whole issue of global change back in 1982 when I was approached by US EPA and actually did a number of studies, particularly studies, and then was involved in a major international study of sea level rise impacts. In fact, it was all the sectors in terms of climate change. So I've been involved in this process for a very, very long time. And as Tony said, since 1997, when I moved down here to Florida and I left the University of Maryland College Park, my main thrust has been hurricanes. But of course, hurricanes are also involved in this global warming situation as well. I'm not going to talk about it today, but clearly that's another issue. And so what I want to talk about today really is the work on sea level rise and coastal impacts, as you see. And we'll go to the next slide, Tony. And I've not worked as much here in Florida. As I mentioned, I spent the last 12 years here in Florida, and I've had to spend 99% of my time on hurricanes because it's such a big issue for Florida and the Southeast. So we've had sponsored one NOAA workshop on climate change here years ago. I worked with Jim Murley on a study he did at Florida Atlantic University and some other things. I've written a couple of papers about this as well in journals and for books. But go to the next slide. I guess we all know the Earth is warming up. That was debatable early on, by the way, in 1982. And it was debatable. Here's some just a slide showing tide gauge records. And here's some of the really long records that show increase, and we see this really around the world. Now, a lot of people thought that the reason that the tide gauges are showing relative sea level rise is because the land was sinking. And we know in some places the land is sinking at relative rates, but we now know quite clearly that that doesn't account for this increase in the water level elevation, that there is a worldwide rise in sea level, which is due to global warming, causing the melting of land-based ice, particularly mid-latitude glaciers, and also as you heat up the water itself, the seawater, it expands. Let's look at the next slide. And, of course, we can look some more, look at this area along the east coast of the United States. And for the southeast, we have a few stations there from North Carolina down to Florida. Again, it's showing relative rates of sea level rise, and actually some of the highest rates are in the Chesapeake Bay area, shown by the Hampton, Virginia area and New Jersey. And I won't go into why that's true, but that is a subsidence issue there. But superimposing that is a long-term trend. We don't have very much subsidence here in Florida. It's pretty much what we call the eustatic signal, that is the actual rise in the water level itself. Okay? We'll look at the next slide. Well, as I mentioned, why does sea level rise? I think most people probably already know this. Addition of meltwater from mountain glaciers has been a big thing, and we all saw the appearance of the 5,000-year-old Iceman a few years ago as the glaciers continue to treat up their valleys, and particularly in Europe and other countries. Ocean thermal expansion is a big factor, and of course, the big unknowns are Greenland and Antarctica. And so those are the ones we're worried about now. And then you look at the importance of sea level rise today. I'm really going to talk about the last one, driving coastal processes, but there's a lot of other important things as well. Okay, let's go to the next slide. And in terms of that, we're going to look at inundation of low-lying areas and erosion of beach and bluffs. And I'm going to sort of take you around the world a little bit because I think that helps a little bit understanding impacts. I've done some work in the Chesapeake Bay and also Louisiana Delta. But I want to show you something, some worldwide things as well, which I think will also amplify this. Let's go to the next slide. All right. I said I was going to take you around the world. So let's look at a place I had the pleasure of working on, Venice, Italy. And Venice is one of those classic cities in the world and quite a rich history. And yet it's suffering from rising sea level and from storm tides. So this is a picture from the air. Let's go to the next slide, a little closer. I took four trips to Venice, and the reason I was there, and this is really about a decade or two ago, because I was working on a project to save Venice from rising water levels. And as you know, it's protected by, if you saw the earlier slide, the Lido Barrier Island, which has three inlets in it. And the problem is, several times, skip to the next slide, several times a year, something like 15 times a year, in fact, the water comes over the sidewalks. If you look at this picture, where the boats are, land where that is a sidewalk, which is usually high and dry, the concrete. And I was there, I guess, fortunately enough or unfortunately enough to be during one of these high water events. This is in November, and this is particularly where they occur in the winter. These are not hurricanes. These are more like winter storms, which don't generate that large a surge compared to what a hurricane does. But again, realize it's a low-lying area like much of the southeast coast of the United States, particularly here in Florida and the Gulf Coast, and Charleston as well. It doesn't take much to rise in sea level to drive the water over the land. Let's look at the next slide. You can see how serious a problem it is there. This is the famous San Marcos Square. And this was built back in the, something like the 12 and 1300s, 1400s. So these are really treasures of the world. And it's salt water is going in, and of course it's destroying the concrete. Some of these buildings have wood doors. They're rotting away. Just enormous amount of damage. Okay, look at the next slide. People walking there, you see, getting around. This is how we got around through the village itself, basically on top of picnic tables. And, now mostly you get around by ferries. There are no cars here, which is actually good. But here you're supposed to be able to walk around on that hard surface. That's the pavement. So you can see it's getting more and more of a problem, and not to try to talk about what solutions are in this area, but the talk was to close these inlets off, these three inlets off, during storm surges and with movable dams, sort of like we have on the Thames River today in London. When a storm surge from the North Sea threatens London, they close these movable dams and close off the Thames to protect London. And that's been a successful project, but it's estimated to do the same thing here, to close the three inlets. It would cost a couple billion dollars. And so far, no one's come up with the money. And the other thing that was a real problem is, if sea level were to rise just 30 to 40 centimeters, then this area would be flooded at all times anyway, so it wouldn't do any good. And I think that's what's really made them realize, the government, that those numbers are pretty small with today's reckoning of where sea levels are going. So maybe spending a couple billion dollars to seal off the inlets doesn't make a lot of sense. And with the present rising sea level and the fact it's accelerating. Okay, next slide. And of course, if we talk about some of the most vulnerable areas in the world are deltas. And Bangladesh, with its millions of people, 1 meter rise in sea level would inundate that whole area in white, flushing out something like over 10 million people. And where are they going to go? And of course, we don't have that many people in New Orleans or in the Mississippi Delta, but Katrina really brought that story home to us and what's happening there. Not just cyclonic impacts, which have been enormous in Bangladesh, and hurricanes in the Delta of Mississippi, but also people living so close to the edge, right at sea level, marshes disappearing, the land disappearing basically, and just the liability and vulnerability there is enormous. Okay, next slide. And this is just the idea of what people call environmental refugees, although we get a lot of static from the State Department about this. U.S. State Department doesn't like that because refugee has sort of a legal connotation. Next slide. Well, let's go to the Chesapeake Bay, because as I mentioned, I was at the University of Maryland College Park for 16 years as a professor. And so it was really, I think in the Chesapeake Bay, it's sort of a microcosm of the type of impacts we're expecting or are seeing already from sea level rise. Of course, we don't have coral reefs there, but I think you'll see on the western shore of the Chesapeake Bay to the left, you have cliffs and that sort of thing. On the eastern shore, very low-lying areas and marshes. Let's look at the next slide. So on the western shore, you find, which surprised a lot of people, I was surprised when I saw this, fairly high cliffs. Those are almost 100-foot cliffs. And this is in Calvert County. And one of the things I did when I lived at the University of Maryland, I took some Senate staffers down to see this, and they were just absolutely flabbergasted. My goodness, we didn't know this is here. It was only an hour and a half from Washington, D.C., so I often find it's good to take people on field trips. If you go out in nature and you actually see what's happening, I say seeing is sort of believing. Now, what you're seeing here are houses sitting on the edge of the cliff. And before this, there are maps that show that there was a road and another couple of lines of houses in front of this. So these cliffs are slowly retreating. The rates are not great. If you see at the base of the cliff, it's actually something called a blue marl. It's like a very hard clay, which is slow to erosion, which is good for the people who live there. Above it is more sandy materials and clay materials, which collapse more easily. But having said that, the rate erosion here is less than a foot per year, which is low. But it is, over time, taking away considerable real estate. I knew some of the people who lived here, and let's look at the next slide, and you can see what's left of one of the houses. This was the kitchen area with the tiles, and that house fell over the edge. So it does happen. It is happening. People are trying to move their houses back, which is the appropriate response here. But this is something that, again, doesn't make a lot of news. In this case, these are individual houses, aren't worth a lot of money. But we're seeing this really around the world. I could take you to places. I've been in England. You find the same thing, big cliffs, houses falling over, all just really Denmark, you know, around the world. Let's look at the next slide. So we're going to go now to the Eastern Shore. This is on the of Maryland, and this is the famous Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge. And I spent many years working there with my colleagues at the University of Maryland, Michael Carney and Court Stevenson, who were both ecologists, and I was sort of the geomorphologist. And they were looking at it, marshes, really, this is going back to the 1980s, as an ecosystem, and I do as well, but I look at it as a geomorphic system as well. And the question was, why are these marshes disappearing so fast? Something like 50% of these marshes have disappeared in the last 50 or so years. And the ecologists were saying, well, it's because of saltwater intrusion, nutria, which was an introduced species, a sort of large varmint was brought in, and it does eat the marsh. And there's also burning of the marshes that, over the short term, can increase productivity, particularly for the ducks and geese and this sort of thing. But if you burn it too deeply, of course, you can burn it into the peat, and that was a concern. So you have to think about the marsh building land and trying to keep its head above sea level. And that's the geomorphic way of thinking of it. And I think of marshes as sort of, and indeed sea level itself, as kind of the dipstick of climate change. All right? It's really a hardwired system. And you see that as the earth warms up, you warm up the seas, and it's really going to have to cause sea level to rise. Sea level to rise is going to impact areas like marshes unless there can be more accumulation on the surface of this marsh, that is, more inorganic material washed in, or if the marsh become more productive and produce more organic production, and that will fall down as litter and build up this peat base. The peat is sort of the dead and trapped organic and inorganic material. That's the only way the marsh can keep its, so you can think of it, keep its head above water. If it doesn't do that and the marsh is sitting there submerged under all tidal cycles, it will die. So let's look at the next slide. And what you see as a marsh dies, a marsh you can walk on, I spend a lot of time walking on marshes, but the first signs are holes in the marsh like you see here. And this, of course, is a mid-latitude marsh. Down here in Florida, we're really more in the mangroves. North Florida does have this, and of course, much of the southeast marshes are the Spartina marshes and other types of high marshes. Well, this is disappearing, and what you're seeing is that the marsh is gone. It's mucky water, and very difficult to walk through an area like this. You really sink down, and it's and also it's telling you that the ecosystem is sort of like a rotten carpet starting to holes develop. It's kind of the analogy I would give. Let's look at the next slide. And there are marshes in the Louisiana Delta which are actually floating. Now, this is the same area about 10 years later. A little different perspective, but now you look at it, you go, my goodness, wow, this thing is just vanishing. In fact, it is. This is an area that was just going very fast. Now we have these turfs, little tufts of marsh left. Those won't last long. So, and as these little shallow lakes get larger, actually wave action can do a little more damage as well. But the big problem is that this marsh, the rate of accumulation on the surface of the marsh to keep, sort of keep the marsh going upward is less than the rate of sea level rise. So this marsh is basically drowning in place. Now there is some advancement, landward advancement, because you realize it's a low-lying area. So there is sort of the leading edge of the marsh. I don't show it to you here, where it's moving over the cornfields. And now, of course, the farmers don't like that in Maryland and Delaware. And they're putting up, trying to stop it, but ultimately they really can't stop that very well. They're turning up, you know, sort of the dirt to try to stop, to build a little bit of a dike or something, but of course the water just goes right through that underneath it. Next slide. But I've talked to farmers who say they're losing something like in Maryland there, that area, about 5 rows of corn a year, meaning the soil is now salty or saline to the point that it can't grow corn. The other thing we found in Chesapeake Bay, it's rather interesting, are these low-lying islands. And some of these islands are really quite famous, one of them named Smith for Captain John Smith, the early English explorer. And there's a whole number of these islands in the teens of them, Tangier and Poplar and others, and they're rapidly disappearing. Here we see trees in a forest that is disappearing. Now, not as dramatically, but we're seeing the same thing actually in the Florida Keys. The Florida Keys are not as erodible. It's on a limestone base, but there's a Pine Key Island which is disappearing. And largely the sea levels come in, and in that case, not so much eroding them out, but the salt water is killing the pine trees. And of course, this is the area for the famous or endangered key deer, the habitat. So that we're seeing, that was the one of the big issues are brought up in the article in the Miami Herald this week. Okay, next slide. Now, if you look at this, there are people who are trying to protect their property. This was a hunting lodge built by an entrepreneur from Baltimore who obviously didn't understand what he's doing. And the erosion is very rapid here. Even the Chesapeake Bay, which doesn't have large waves, about 10, 15 feet a year. And so the erosion started taking this. Then he built a bulkhead. You see it out in the water. And that eroded away, and now he sort of realized it's hopeless. Now, in all truthfulness, we could have stopped this. He could have stopped this. But the cost of engineering sometimes exceeds the value of what you're trying to protect. And that was the trade-off here. And also, of course, in the process of building these engineering structures, you're building a sterile shoreline, these bulkheads. And so there's a lot of environmental cost of trying to stabilize areas, particularly like this area in the Chesapeake Bay. So by and large, the state of Maryland has sort of moved away from this hard stabilization as much as they can. At one time, it was actually encouraged. But thinking has really changed in the last 20 or so years, thank goodness. Okay, next slide. Now, this is an island called Poplar Island, south of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge area on the eastern shore. And this is from maps, 1941, 1987. And you can see this Poplar Island rapidly disappearing. One time in the 1840s, over 100 families lived here and had farms. There was a post office, a church, a lighthouse. It was a thriving community, if you can imagine. In fact, when FDR was president, he went to Poplar Island. That was his number one retreat. He didn't really like Camp David very much. Okay? Look at the next slide, and we'll see what Poplar Island looks like, or did look like. That's about all it looked like about 15 years ago when I took class trips in the University of Maryland. College students out there to look at it, you can see it's pretty much clay-based with some sand and easily eroded away. Now, since this time, the city of Baltimore, the port of Baltimore, need a place to dispose of clean fill, and they've barged down a huge amount of fill, and this island's been somewhat restored, actually as a refuge for the black ducks, which are endangered species. There are some people who live in Maryland who really don't like that, not that they don't like black ducks. They said, you didn't save the land for us, you saved them for the ducks. So you kind of get into that sort of back and forth as well. But it was probably a good thing because they were running out of locations to put the dredge fill. It was clean fill. It was not from the inner harbor, which is contaminated. It was from the outer harbor. But that's what's left of Poplar Island. You see that, and there's many, many more cases. I did a film called Vanishing Lands, a documentary about this years ago, and published with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service a brochure about this. By the way, I lost my screen. Is that a problem? It's back. I guess I didn't move enough. Okay, go ahead. Next slide. I guess I was talking too long here. Well, now let's look at erosion, because erosion directly, particularly erosion where people have their houses, is a big issue. And people have houses, they want the view of the water, and when we get as close as they can, but sometimes the view gets too good. And here's some houses south of Boston. Again, I lived on Cape Cod and taught at Boston University for a while before coming down to the University of Maryland. So this is the area around Scituate and the cliffs down that area. And those houses are either going to move back or they're going to fall to the edge. They're probably gone. Many of them did move back. And you can see these are, in this area, you wouldn't think that's an expensive house, but it is. Anything around the Boston area is pretty expensive, as it is here in Miami. Okay, next slide. This is Outer Cape Cod. I was there during a storm. Now, a lot of people think all the erosion is storm-driven. And they sort of discount sea level rise. They discount global warming. They say, oh, the storm did it. That's it. And I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes. But I think the way you have to think about this is that if it was just storms coming and going, there were no sea level rise, then the beaches shouldn't be eroding, per se, in most areas. The sand should recover. It should be moved back on shore. We see a lot of recovery, but we don't see it all. In fact, I spent the last 20 years of my life, spent a lot of time doing historical shoreline change analysis of the beaches from Massachusetts down to North Carolina. I didn't really come this far down at that time. Did it for a number of agencies, including state agencies and coastal zone management programs. And what you see is the gradual march back, in some places not so gradual, rapid march back in Cape Hatteras area up to 15 feet a year over the last 100 years. That's the reason we had to move the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. And by the way, this is Cape Cod, area called Coast Guard Beach. And this was during the blizzard of 1978, long ago, I guess, for a lot of people. But we've had blizzards since then. But this is the one that doomed that parking lot and the pavilion. There's the whole story there. But let's move on for now. But the story I want to say is, yes, storms do a lot of erosion, but it's sea level rise. It sets up, what we call the profile out of equilibrium, the beach profile, so that erosion continues and progresses over time. Now, a lot of people say, oh, you know, it's fun. It's you know, these people deserve to have their houses fall in the water. I must say, I hate to see them fall in the water. I mean, it makes good pictures and such, but I do feel for the people. I know the people own this house on Fire Island, New York, on the south shore of Long Island, and their grandfather showed a map that showed two dunes and a wide beach in front of the house when this house was built in the 1880s. This house fell in during the 1991 nor'easter, so-called the storm from hell, which put seawater on the I guess it's the, trying to think of the expressway, it's the FDR expressway in downtown Manhattan, and actually some water in the Battery, which is one reason people in New York City are very afraid of a hurricane coming that way, and storm surges actually going over the Battery, the lower part of Manhattan, and maybe even putting water in subways. But that's another story. But back to this particular issue, that house did fall in the water. It was on Fire Island. But then you look at the next slide. What did people learn from that? Not much. Here's a house in the Hamptons. In the winter, you see the ice in the background. And this guy built this castle, absolute castle, on the Southampton Barrier. And we try to talk to him, and he owns everything from the ocean to the bay. Try to talk to him, building back where the trees are. He built on the sand dune here. And he basically said, well, you know, I'm really smart. I made $100 million, and I know what I'm doing. You see, he's already tried sandbags, and now, you know, he's trying all sorts of things. The foundation's starting to crack. So coming on down the coast, well, no, we're still in the same area. I always like this picture of a house. It's for sale. Everybody write down that number. Right. This one's already fallen in. So it's kind of interesting to see these houses on the edge like this, but it's the bigger story is it's happening today. We don't have to wait for the future. And that's the other thing, that it's happening on the shore today. So we'll look at the next slide. In Ocean City, Maryland, that's one of my favorite areas. We call it Washington Sandbox. And this is a pretty old shot, but I want to show it because they have changed their regulations there. But this was a developer who proved he could build his house out on the beach and get away with it. It was already eroding, but that house, of course, was destroyed by the next storm. So, you know, everybody thinks that they got the answers, and there's all sorts of people come with devices trying to stop the erosion. I get people all the time with new inventions and patents and want me to sign disclosure forms, non-disclosure forms. I'm thinking, oh, come on. So this is too big to fight really like this, but go ahead, next slide. And I kind of like this one. It's a little bit out of focus, but this is a slide I took in Buxton Woods in the Cape Hatteras area. The lighthouse is just to the south, where the lighthouse stood before, just to the south of here. Again, this is a winter nor'easter, and we were there at the very end of this storm, and you can see, if you look to the top of the slide, that's North Carolina Highway 12, the only way in and out of the Outer Banks, North Carolina. This is the village of Buxton. That's a motel, and if you look on the edge of that building with the white top, white roof, somebody rudely checked out of unit number one. There's nothing there anymore. The overwash, the storm surge is coming in. You see the overwash sand, one of the houses tilt fallen in. But then if you look, again, sort of the middle of the slide to the left, there's a new house under construction and people on top of the house hammering away. So during the tail end of the storm, this is in November, so it wasn't that cold there, people were building new houses. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, we got flood insurance. Not a problem. So again, I've worked with FEMA before, but you know, there's a lot of subsidies really on the shore, and everybody wants to be there, and it's just, to me, kind of flabbergasting. They're finishing up this house in the midst of a storm, and things are falling in. So I think that kind of encapsulates the problem we have. Next slide. And I know that Tony lives there in Charleston, and we all love the low country. This is an area called Folly Island after Hurricane Hugo hit it. I think that was 1989. I was just there before the Hugo hit it. And it's, again, everybody said the hurricane did it. Sure, that was a Category 4 hurricane, but Folly Island had a long-term erosion problem, been fighting erosion for years and years, and the hurricane just dramatically puts an exclamation point behind this erosion problem and the problem of living right at the water's edge. And so, as you can see, this area continues to erode, and I understand there's been a beach nourishment project on the south end of this. And actually, what's sort of ironic is after there was so much damage to Folly Island, and it kind of had been run down, frankly, its glory days were back in the 40s or so when they had prize boxing there, and it sort of run down. But after it was all over, real estate values came up because the developers were able to clear all this old development away, get rid of it, and lay out some nicer houses. That's the I think that's the Holiday Inn there is the building that's standing. First floor and the second floor. The first floor is completely blown out by the storm surge, washed through, and the second floor is impacted as well. But that's kind of the ironic thing. We're seeing this now on the Mississippi coast. People are talking about, oh yeah, we're going to rebuild. We got to rebuild. It's sort of like it's the American way, and yet we're rebuilding there, and particularly in the face of pretty often hurricane strikes and also huge storm surges. That 30-foot storm surge that Katrina developed in coastal Mississippi was not an accident. It was not a freak. This is the kind of surges they get there. They're preordained for massive storm surges, and I could talk a lot about that, but let's go on in the interest of time.
I just want to add one thing, Dr. Leatherman. That yeah. Holiday Inn just finished a $5 million renovation last week.
Oh, really? My
yeah.
goodness. It was interesting. The first floor, they have a bulkhead around it, if you see it. I don't know if they've reinforced that. But it washed through, and it was interesting. The rooms that were on the first floor and the second floor, it took everything out the back. They had back doors. It took all the furniture out, too. The surge did. The only thing it left was the paintings on the wall. I guess they're afraid of theft. Those paintings were on the wall, really something impressive. We did our post-storm surveys. Anyway, this is a cartoon. This is actually from, I think it's from Malibu, when they were having storms. And, you know, we got to do something about beach erosion. Well, I think there's we got to back up and think about what's causing that and go back in the chain, because beach erosion and flooding are sort of the end point of where we're going. Something's behind all that. So let's look at the next slide. So now if you look, I talked about gathering this huge data set, which really consumed a decade or two of my life. What you see here is just very, very generalized data based on millions and millions of data points. I won't belabor how we collected all this at high resolution, but what it shows is over the last 100 years, this is over 100 plus year data, the trend in terms of eroding, accretion, stability. And you can see the preponderance of areas are eroding. In fact, on a nationwide basis, it's almost 90% of areas where, not counting hard rock areas, I'm talking about beach areas, anything not, I mean, obviously Maine doesn't have much of an erosion problem because most of it's hard rock, although there are some beaches, Pompano beaches and others. But for erodible sandy shores, it's about 90%. And actually, our survey showed this is pretty true around the world where good data are around. So except for areas where there's local sand sources from offshore, except for areas where there are rivers which are divulging sediments to the shore still, by and large, it's telling the trend. And again, it's sort of a hardwired system. You raise sea level, you're pushing shorelines in. It's not just flooding. It's not just inundation. It's erosion. Erosion is, it's only about 10% of actually just sort of the bathtub effect of flooding. It's actually physical removal of material offshore to reestablish what we call an equilibrium profile. Let's look at the next slide. Now, what I mentioned before is that there is a variable rate of erosion. There's variable rates of sea level rise. So if you plot along the East Coast of the United States, there's data from South Carolina, North Carolina, Long Island, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and such. And DMV means Delaware, Maryland, Virginia. Some people call that Delmarva. We'll put that together. But anyway, if you look at sea level rise rate, which varies along the coastline, as I mentioned earlier, because there is a more subsidence in some areas than others, so and along the Atlantic coast of the United States. And then if you look at the rate of sea level rate of shoreline change, meters per year, there's actually a correlation. And we're kind of the first to show that because it took a massive amount of data to show this little simple plot. And what that says is, again, if you increase the rate of sea level rise, you're going to increase the erosion rate. Now, that may not seem like rocket science, but this is something in the coastal world and professionally was very hard to demonstrate until we put together this massive data set to do this, which is shown as a very simple plot. And so, and I tell people, people say, well, that's, we already knew that. I said, yeah, I think we already knew that cigarettes caused cancer. But how long did it take to get the huge amount of statistical data together to prove it? And this is the same thing. This is millions of data points that went in, these simple points on the line to make this little plot. And that's what it took, 20 years to put this together to get there. With smoking, I took at least 20 or 30 years to get statistical data together on mortality and smoking and all that. And I don't want to say we're causing the deaths that smoking did or such an ill, but it is a big problem economically for the country, erosion. And it tells you that with accelerated sea level rise, that the erosion rate's only going to get worse. And I think that's the take-home point. As bad as it is now, and it is not good. And as much as money as people are spending now, particularly here in the state of Florida, we spend a lot of money on nourishing beaches. And I understand it. Here in Southeast Florida, if we didn't have beaches, I don't think we'd have many tourists. As they say, as the beaches go, so goes the tourists and so goes the economy in a lot of these areas. And I kind of think of Florida as a souffle. I don't know if anybody's ever said that before. Kind of hard around the edges economically and soft in the middle, except for Disneyland, except for Orlando. The real economic engine is the shore here, is the coastline, and I think Jim Early certainly knows that very well in his publications. Let's look at the next slide. Well, I told you that it's not just a U.S. problem. I did some work, as I mentioned, U.S. EPA went to Marshall Islands. This was a, in World War II, this was a gun emplacement. It was used to try to deal with the Japanese invasion, presumably. And now, of course, that's all over. Now it's out in the ocean. So it's a fight in a different war and losing this one. Next slide. I'll just show a few of these because I think they're kind of interesting landmarks. This is Malaysia. This is a beach called the Beach of a Thousand Loves. It's eroding, we showed, about 8 feet a year. So it's down, I think, to a beach of about 100 loves. It's eroding pretty significantly. Just a few more just for fun. Then we'll move on to South Florida. Oh, this is the Chinese coast, the North Chinese coast. I don't know if people realized it, but during the Korean War, when this bunker was built, the Chinese were absolutely convinced that we're going to invade China next after we took over Korea. And they built a series of these batteries along their pillboxes, along their coast, which have subsequently fallen over the cliff or over the sand dune into the water. You see them today. And again, think back, how long was the Korean War back in the 50s? Not that long ago. By the way, you see the pillboxes along the French coast and the Danish coast from World War II, that is the Nazi pillboxes, a lot of them also have fallen into the water and down the beach. Next slide. So it's a worldwide phenomenon. And the Great Wall of China, east end of that is eroding. Okay, next slide. We'll move on. Okay, let's get into Florida, because I think that's what people want to hear a little bit about. And I really haven't done as much work in Florida as some of my colleagues, particularly Kirji Zhang here and Michael Ross and others, because they've really had the time to concentrate more to it. But let me just show a little bit of work that Kirji and I have been doing. And Kirji's writing some more major papers that are going to be coming out shortly. Well, if we look at this slide, I think most people recognize where we are. To the right, the urbanized area is Miami. You can see the corridor there coming down to Homestead and Florida City. And then we see basically South Florida Bay and the start of the Keys. And so this area is very low lying. You can see sort of a good part of the Everglades, the southern part of the Everglades. Let's look at the next slide. Now, if you look at some air photos, we can see that sea level rise is causing the advancement of, or the retreat of, the freshwater wetlands and the advancement of the salt saline type wetlands, which are shown in red. So we're seeing a shift. And indeed, because the Everglades is this very broad, sort of low-lying river, which is very subject. So you raise sea level just a small amount, you're going to push this saltwater wedge in something like 1,000 times the amount of sea level rise vertically. So things happen faster, and they are happening faster. Let's look at the next slide. I think I have a few more. Oh, well, I didn't put the others in here, but this was something in the Sports Illustrated. Now, I helped them with this, but certainly hope that we don't see this sort of thing realized. They were worried about stadiums. I'm not worried about stadiums so much. I'm worried about where I'm living and everybody else. So those of us who live in South Florida say, "Oh my God, this would be, certainly the doomsday scenario, Antarctica melting or Greenland completely melting," and certainly don't think that that's. I don't think this is what we want to run with. But, it's been in Sports Illustrated, it's been around, people have seen it, but I think we need to look more at what even a 1 meter rise in sea level, I say even a 1 meter rise in sea level will do. Because keep in mind, all this erosion I've been showing you on these slides is due to a 1 foot rise in sea level. And so 1 foot rise in sea level, or a third of a meter, is already causing enormous problems. We don't have to go to a 5 meter rise in sea level like this slide shows to see huge problems occurring. Okay, next slide. Well, the other thing I want to show, and I actually was going to show you a few more slides, but Kirji's got an article. Kirji Zhang, my colleague, is coming out, so I just didn't put those in. Coming out in publication soon, so stay tuned. He's got some detailed data here in South Florida where he's shown as sea level rise up what's going to happen in a very detail using LIDAR, airborne LIDAR data, very precise data and population data. So I sort of kept those out because that article will be coming out shortly. But what we have now is, of course, what we've had for the last 15, 20 years or so is the Topaz Poseidon satellite system, which gives us the ability not just to look at particular sites where we have tide gauges, but look at the whole world's surface of the water and how it's changing. Look at the next slide. Go to the next slide. And it's very complicated, but what we do see is, in fact, that the sea level is increasing, and in fact, the rate of sea level rise looks to have gone up by 50% or so. The long-term trend we see from tide gauges was about 2 millimeters per year, 1.8 to 2 millimeters per year. The satellite data from night is showing about 3 millimeters per year, and that's very worrisome. That's a 50% increase, and if that continues to be realized, and again, keep in mind, a lot of people say millimeters, that means nothing. Well, millimeters add up, and we've seen what they've done. And again, sea level rise is almost insidious because it's not any one day that it's a problem, but over a period of a decade or so, it becomes a major problem. I can tell you, I go to Matheson Hammock Park to launch our boat. That's here in the Miami area. And if it's a moon tide, that is a spring tide, when the tides are larger, spring tides, a lot of times we go to launch the boat. We're launching the boat from water into water because the parking lots are flooded with salt water. Not very good. And how did that happen? Well, this is a very old marina. I should have brought some slides of that, but next time I go, I'll take them. But, when this was built 30, 40, 50 years ago, obviously they didn't build it where the tides were coming across the parking lot. Now they're starting to add more pavement and trying to add to build that up. But that's what I'm talking about. It's sort of a nuisance now. It's becoming more of a problem. There was an article in the Miami Herald I helped them with last year where they're having flooding around 15th Street in Miami Beach. They were wondering, what's going on? And the water was backing up through the drains, the drain pipes. Well, we did have spring tides, but it's just showing you that parts of Miami Beach are right at sea level and the water's coming through the drains. And people are walking through a foot or so of water trying to, they're saying, get to their car, get to Starbucks. Very annoying. And this persisted for a week or so. So again, we're starting to see these signals of places having problems, and you might call them annoying now, but over time, like Venice, it becomes more than annoying. It becomes a major problem. Let's look at the next slide. I think I'm about through with the slides today. It don't take too much time. Well, again, where's sea level going? I mean, there's all been all sorts of estimates. This is from the, I think it's the IPCC, and some people say those are too low. I mean, the big outliers of what's happening in Greenland, because it's a temperate glacier, it's right at the melting temperature. And Antarctica, again, there's a lot of conjecture about that. It's much colder, but if icebergs the size of Rhode Island break off, Katie bar the door. That's going to be serious, serious problems. But I think much less is known about Antarctica than Greenland. And Greenland, again, we're seeing land we never saw before. Again, keep in mind, all these areas go through cycles. I'm not a glaciologist. I have colleagues at NASA Goddard who are studying it, like Dr. Claire Parkinson and others. And they point out there are big cycles. But it is very worse than what we're seeing. And they're talking now about ice clear Arctic for ships to go through. We certainly haven't seen that in a long time. So next slide, I think that's about it. But yeah, people say the life is a beach, but even that seems to be slipping away. Let's hope not. And maybe through our work and working together, we can try to start to address some of these problems. And it's interesting, in the world of hurricane work, we talk about mitigation. And mitigation means trying to harden your house, but other people use the word mitigation adaptation differently in the climate worlds. So I think that concludes my presentation. I could take a few questions if people have questions or comments or anything else if we have time.